Hi, I'm Joe Palca.
And I'm Christopher Joyce.
We're both correspondents on the science desk at NPR, and this is another edition of the NPR podcast on science. Today we'll hear about what happens when you're 5 years old and you discover a fundamental law of physics.
And we'll also hear the latest about what astrophysicists say is some of the weirdest stuff in the universe. And we'll have a report on why geologists are worried that Indonesia faces another devastating tsunami.
But first, how'd you like to buy the Brooklyn Bridge? Trust me, it's a great deal. Your very own bridge. Not buying it? Well, how do you feel about buying an energy-efficient appliance or a gas-sipping car? Now, Chris, you talked about this in a piece this week on Morning Edition. How do you get people to do the right thing and buy things that they should be buying for the planet?
Well, one thing that people in the efficiency business are doing and the conservation business is going to social marketers. These are people who specialize in getting people to do things they might not otherwise do. When you think back to smoking and the anti-smoking campaigns, they hired social marketers. But the techniques that worked to make people stop smoking won't work to make people save energy.
No. I guess partly because you're not going to die if you...
Right.
Yeah.
Fear is what a lot of the anti-smoking people used. And it was easy because all they had to do was show a picture of a set of black lungs and you got people to pay attention. Energy is not inherently evil and people need energy. So how do you get them to use less of it? And the thing that the conservationists have been depending on has been price. The fact is that when the prices go up, you use less. When prices go down, you use more. We're seeing that right now.
You mean people are starting to get back in their cars because the price of gas has gone down?
I think people are buying Hummers again.
Yeah, right. But there was a moment in your piece where you talked about, you know, one of the tools of social marketing is to get social leaders to do the right thing. And you mentioned Jimmy Carter putting on a sweater so that people would feel more comfortable about turning down their thermostat. Complete bust.
It was a bust because it was couched as a moral issue.
Ah.
And the fact is that even though the efficiency people don't want you to depend on price, they do want to be able to convince you that you're going to save money because the pocketbook is still the best way to reach people. So this is what the Energy Star program does in this part of the Department of Energy. They show people that they can save in the long run, even if they have to pay a little more up front, they can save on energy costs if they buy an energy-saving refrigerator. It may only be $8 a year, but it seems to work. The other thing that they're finding from social marketing is that you want to try to make people feel that they're smart.
Okay, what's an example of one of these marketing programs?
Oh, let's see. The Alliance to Save Energy comes to mind because they've been doing a lot of social marketing on how to save energy in appliances and in cars, and they've got one for their Drive Smarter challenge. I mean, it's named Smarter. And it's a baby in a back seat. It's a radio spot. There's a baby in the back seat, and the baby pipes up and starts talking to his mom. And the mom says, "Oh, my baby's so smart." And the baby says, "Yes, you bet I'm smart. And if you don't stop those jackrabbit starts, and if you don't fill up your tires properly, you're just not going to get good mileage. And you know, you can save so much money doing this." And she says, "Oh, I'm so much smarter now." So they're really hitting that idea of be smart.
There was a great video on NPR's website accompanying your story. I thought that was hilarious. People should go look at it. It's about static electricity. I won't say any more. But I was on Science Friday this week hosting it, and we did an interesting talk, not so much about doing the right thing, but there's this guy called Paco Underhill who's written a book called The Science of Selling. And it's just fascinating the kinds of tricks and tools that that marketers use and some failed to use to get people to buy in a store, to feel comfortable about it. And one of the things that I particularly like is he talks about the entryway of a store as being a landing zone. If you put something in the entryway, people are going to walk right past it. So you have to put the directions further into the store. I was just in Macy's yesterday, and you know you don't get directions to the store until you're already in and near the elevator or escalator, because they figure you're going to walk right past it. You're zooming into the store. So even the layout of where you put things is really remarkable. Okay, so from the sales floor to the ocean floor. Ever since that massive earthquake and tsunami that washed over Southeast Asia in 2004, geologists have been monitoring a fault line in the Indian Ocean. More than 200,000 people died in the last disaster, and now scientists say they're worried about a recurrence. Chris, you have the story.
That's right. Geologists, they don't usually predict earthquakes, but they will make qualified forecasts. And For the past 3 years, they've been saying, watch out. We don't know exactly when or where, but another big quake and tsunami could happen in the Indian Ocean. And now scientists from the California Institute of Technology, working with colleagues in Indonesia, say they think it's coming pretty soon.
It'll probably happen in the lifetimes of children who are alive today.
Aaron Meltzner is a geologist and an author on a paper in this week's issue of the journal Science. He and his colleagues have used an unusual marker to track the history of quakes, the growth patterns of microatolls. These are small coral formations. They look like sombreros a few yards across. They are created when the seabed moves up and down before or during quakes. Whenever the top of the coral is pushed up out of the water and exposed to air, it stops growing up but continues to grow out, making the sombrero shape. The growth lines in these coral sombreros tell a 700-year story of the seafloor's rise and fall, punctuated with sudden quakes, and they show a cycle.
It's basically this pattern of a century or so with no earthquakes, then a cluster of moderate earthquakes that's anywhere from a few decades to nearly a century long, and every time that we have documented this, which is about four times now, it culminates with kind of the granddaddy of them all, the big magnitude 8.8 to 9.0.
The team looked at microatolls on islands along the Mentawai Fault. It's part of the much longer Sunda Trench that runs parallel to the island of Sumatra. A rupture in the northern section of the Sunda Trench caused the 2004 disaster. And now the Mentawai section of the fault is acting up. There was a big quake there last September. Meltzner suspects that was the start of a new quake cluster in the latest cycle. He says the Mentawai granddaddy could be on the way, and scientists who studied the fault say it still has a lot of tension in it.
So that fault, even though it just had a major earthquake, is still at a high state of stress, and it's really a ticking bomb, so to speak, on a timescale of several decades.
The government of Indonesia will be better prepared if and when the big one does come. Indonesia inaugurated its own tsunami warning system last November. Patricio Bernal heads the UN Intergovernmental Oceanic Commission. He says maps of where another tsunami might hit encouraged Indonesia to invest in the necessary equipment.
People see what portion of a given city with hospitals, schools, and all the infrastructure there will be inundated by a tsunami. So then people sort of react and say, oh, we have a problem.
Indonesia has placed 3 undersea detectors in the ocean to warn of a tsunami, and with other Indian Ocean countries, they've put 23 seismometers around the Indian Ocean to detect quakes. Bernal was in Indonesia during a recent earthquake and saw the warning system in action.
They issue a warning over the night, so that warning did reach the population. So I'm much more confident today that the system are slowly evolving to a point where they can be fully effective for warning the population.
Okay, so the question is, Chris, is he right? Is there really an effective warning system?
The only true way to find out, unfortunately, is to test it. And
you mean test it?
Test the system. I mean, you know, there'll be an earthquake.
Why can't they just test it without a...
Well, the thing is that you can test all the instruments. That's fine. But the proof of the pudding is, will people move and will they move fast enough? Aaron Meltzner was telling me he's been to the city of Padang, a city of 750,000 people on the coast of Sumatra, which would be the first place hit if there is a tsunami from this particular fault. Padang is basically an island. It's separated from the mainland by a body of water over which there are 2 bridges. Now, if they get 25 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes warning from their new instrumentation that's out in the ocean, great. But how do you evacuate a city of 750,000 people across 2 bridges in an hour, maybe 2? These are the imponderables that limit what science can do. And at the end, it's more a matter of moving people from one place to another in trucks, buses, trains, and however else you can move them.
Yeah. Moving on.
Oh!
Did you hear a duck? Oh, that probably means it's time for the next story.
Okay, let's talk about nothing. This is a story about nothing. Scientists are reporting new details about a mysterious force known as dark energy. Astronomers stumbled across dark energy a decade ago. Since then, they've been trying to learn more about what it is and where it is hiding. As Joe reported on All Things Considered, dark energy seems to exist where scientists said once there was nothing.
That word nothing. Scientists have a way of hijacking words and giving them new meanings. In the 60s, you probably remember, physicists made off with the words color and charm to describe subatomic particles known as quarks. Well, now they're trying to take over the word nothing.
50 years ago, nothing was considered very boring. Today, nothing is the focus of much forefront research in physics and in astrophysics.
Michael Turner is an astrophysicist at the University of Chicago. According to Turner, scientists now think the nothing of space is actually filled with a poorly understood force called dark energy. After the Big Bang, the universe went through a period of expansion. But the laws of gravity decreed that eventually that expansion would slow down. Certainly by now, some 13 billion years after the Big Bang. But when they did the measurements a decade ago, to their astonishment, they discovered not only that the expansion wasn't slowing down, it was speeding up. Something had to be driving it. But what? Turner says astrophysicists are still trying to figure that out.
Where we stand right now is we have words that we tell one another, which is that the universe is filled with the weirdest substance that we've ever run across, called dark energy. And that unlike ordinary stuff whose gravity is attractive, the gravity of dark energy is repulsive, and that repulsive gravity is pushing the universe apart, causing the expansion to speed up and not slow down.
And Turner says astrophysicists believe all that dark energy is actually hiding out in what used to be called nothing. In other words, at least to astrophysicists, nothing is really something. But exactly what dark energy is still a mystery. Scientists have been looking for other signs of how it's shaping the universe. Now they have one. Alexei Viklinin and his colleagues at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, used the Chandra X-ray Observatory to study the growth of galaxy clusters. Dark energy should have a measurable effect on that growth. In fact, their rate of growth should change at the same time the expansion of the universe starts speeding up. Viklinin says that's just what they saw.
This change in the rate of growth has occurred exactly at the point where we believe the universe entered the acceleration phase. So this is an unmistakable signature of dark energy effects.
Viklinin's results will appear in the February 10th issue of the Astrophysical Journal. Astrophysicist Michael Turner says, of course, there could be another explanation for the behavior of the galaxy clusters and the accelerating expansion.
It could be that all this talk about dark energy is just much ado about nothing.
In the Shakespearean sense of the word.
And that there is no dark energy out there. It's just that we don't understand gravity.
But that would mean Einstein got it wrong when he made predictions about gravity in his theory of general relativity. Viklinin says that kind of radical rewriting of the laws of physics is not necessary. His results, although strange, do fit in Einstein's theories.
And what we find is all the effects can in fact be still described by Einstein's gravity.
In other words, for now at least, it looks like Einstein didn't get nothing wrong. Come on, that was hilarious. I laughed out loud when I thought that up.
And you still are, obviously.
Yeah, probably the only one.
Okay, we're going to finish up this week with a piece by Robert Krulwich. A professor at MIT likes to ask her students to recall a moment very early in their lives. It's a moment when they began to think like scientists. The students answer by writing essays, which Professor Sherry Turkle has collected for the past 25 years. She recently published a selection of them, including one from a student who went on to a career as a computer scientist. And her essay caught Krulwich's ear.
One day, when computer scientist Erica Carmel was just 5 years old,
I was in our playroom at home, and I had this egg basket that was clearly from an Easter basket with those little plastic eggs.
And Erica decided that what she wanted to do right then was to recreate a Disneyland experience.
I think I had been in Disneyland recently with my grandparents, and they had the nice gondola.
You know, that ski lift thing that takes you up in the air on wires so you can then look down at Fantasyland and down at Frontierland. So Erica, she looked at her jump rope and at her Easter basket.
And decided to create a gondola. So took jump rope, tied it to the doorknob, and
stretched that rope.
Yes.
All the way across her playroom to a bookshelf on the opposite wall.
Climbed up on the top of the bookshelf, tied it to the top of the bookshelf, which of course parents loved me doing.
And now with the rope
at a slant?
Yes.
She takes the egg basket, she hangs it onto the rope, lets it go, and of course
it slides down to the other side of the room. So at that point, that worked, which probably made it less exciting.
Then, because she's a little bored, she took the rope in her hands and she thought,
kind of, yeah, it would be fun to make it go back and forth.
So she began to swing the rope.
Might get the basket swinging.
Side to side.
Back and forth.
Gently at first.
Back and forth. A little bit higher. Back and forth. A little bit higher. Back and forth.
And why not? She gives it a real swing.
And
the basket makes a complete turn up and over.
All the way around the rope.
360.
With the eggs in.
With the eggs in.
And amazingly, the eggs don't fall out.
Which is very, very surprising.
Did you do it a second time?
Did a second and a third time.
The eggs stayed in every time?
Yes. And then, of course, I had to try it the other way to make sure that they really should have fallen out. So I take the basket, untie it, put the eggs in, turn it upside down, and sure enough, the eggs fell out. I had discovered something. Whatever it was that made things fall no longer applied when you made them move around in circles.
Can you remember what that felt like when you were the first person in the entire world to know about this secret thing about eggs and baskets?
Oh, incredible. Such excitement, which is why I still remembered it 20 years later. Just that sheer excitement. So I run out of the room.
Clearly she had to tell somebody about this.
Dad, I discovered this magical force, and I think I probably dragged him into the room. And he kind of looked at me like, okay, what is it that you discovered?
Did you realize that you were not the first at that moment, or were you just puzzled by his unexcitement?
No, at that point, I was crushed. I was crushed.
Okay, skip forward 13 years. Now Erica Carmel is in college.
Yes, so I end up at MIT. I'm taking physics, which every single member of the freshman class is taking, with Walter Lewin.
Walter Lewin is one of those legendary physics teachers famous for bringing a bucket filled with water for his demonstration of centrifugal force.
So he's got his pail of water, and he starts to swing it back and forth, higher and higher and higher, and then his arm goes in a full circle, and the pail goes completely upside down, and sure enough, the water stays in the pail.
And you are thinking,
I knew that.
Even though at 17 she could admit centrifugal force was not really my discovery?
It is still my discovery.
Because?
Because I made the discovery myself.
Robert Grulwich, NPR News.
Hey, Chris, you know what? I just made a discovery.
Okay, tell me what.
We don't have any more pieces to play.
Brilliant.
So that's it for this edition of On Science. Hope everybody has a great holiday. We'll be back.
Goodbye. Good luck.
I'm Joe Palca.
I'm Christopher Joyce.